welcome to the August 12th, 2003 edition of Ecologic, Our Common Fate, a forum for the expression of ecological thought, analysis, and activist endeavor. Today, the formative years, the ecology of childhood development. Join us as we assess children's health and well-being through an ecological lens. What can we learn from indigenous ways of bringing children into the world? Can an ecological model of the immune system improve both family and community health? And how do parents and children become empowered to cope with the challenges posed by institutionalized violations of personal and intergenerational well-being? Join us as we explore this and more with my co-hosts for the hour, Pika Trinkle, herbalist, homeopath, natural health advocate, on WBAI in New York with yours truly, David O. Welcome to Ecologic on WBAI in New York. Couple of quick announcements. The No Spray Coalition at nospray.org, N-O-S-P-R-A-Y.org, at 718-670-7110. They are organizing to mount a defense to the senseless spraying of chemicals in New York City, around New York City. Pesticides leave toxic legacy, short and long-term respiratory problems, immune and nervous system disruption, cancer, reproductive and learning disorders, and do nothing to establish a sustainable environment and prudent public health policy surrounding the alleged West Nile virus. Please get involved with the No Spray Coalition. There is ground-based spraying going on in areas of Queens and Staten Island, and we need many people to become part of the effort to bring intelligence and sustainability to New York City policy. That's the No Spray Coalition at 718-670-7110, nospray.org. And one thing that is happening in Westchester County is very important. There's an airport, the Westchester County Airport, and there are people who are attempting to expand this airport while the airport itself is on the edge of the major Kensico Reservoir, the watershed holding reservoir for most of the water for our area. And there's the importance of permanently protecting the Kensico Reservoir from the threat of expansion at the Westchester County Airport. Westchester County air already falls way below the national standards for clean air. The airport adds additional unreported pollution into our drinking water supply, and it puts public health at further risk. Airplanes emit more than 83 major pollutants, including butane, benzene, sulfuric acid, ammonia, and nitric acid. Pollutants from airplane emissions are known to cause many diseases such as cancer, heart problems, liver damage, asthma, and emphysema. An environmental conference in Copenhagen of 159 countries considers the aviation industry the most polluting in the world. Unlike other industries in the U.S., they do not have to report their toxic emissions. Yet this airport is in great danger of expanding. By today's environmental standards, this airport could never be built at its current location. Please get involved. We need many people to get involved with this issue, as the airport, the development of the airport, needs to be frozen and expansion must not proceed. Please contact the Croton Watershed Clean Water Coalition at 914-234-6470, 914-234-6470. That's newyorkwater.org, full spelling newyorkwater.org. And as a service to the listener, I would like to do just a brief update and overview of Pacifica governance issues. whereas at a spot where the new bylaws are all but ratified to guide the governance of the Pacifica Foundation into the future, the interim Pacifica National Board and members of local station boards are poised to meet this weekend to mediate upon the differences surrounding the way in which the bylaws should or should not address diversity issues within the Pacifica Foundation. I'd like to contextualize this because I believe that this really cuts to the heart of issues on what progressives, what left progressives feel is the way to move. There are many, many differences of opinion on the ways to move, and I think the rhetoric can become inflammatory, which is not helpful because I think people have to be assessed on the merits of their intellectual arguments, and I think the argument should be in that realm. As a brief intro to this, there was a article by Victor Good called Crisis on the Campus, in which he described how the University of Michigan employed social science experts to measure and track the impact of diversity on the quality of the campus educational environment. And they found that heterogeneous groups interact differently and offer more creative solutions to problem solving. In other words, they found that it was beneficial to have diversity within groups' decision making and bodies of groups wherever they may be. And they found that meaningful integration has always been a result of what they called persistent social engineering, what this author referred to as social engineering. You can call it managed environments where the results, the goals are managed. Integration, this viewpoint stresses that integration rarely, if ever, just happens, that it is necessary to bring about integration as a social good through management and through managed decision making. Now, this is where you need to see that the people who are saying, I believe just to report objectively on the people who are saying that we need to consider how we do this, that there are people on the left who feel that managed diversity, managed democratization has to be assessed on its merits and process. There's a what would be called a process that would be independent from managed decision making. So the proportional representation electoral system, which the Pacifica governance is going to put into place, has a system that is designed into it to create diversity through proportional representation. And the people who are questioning the need for bureaucracy to manage diversity, say process diversity, process democratization, can achieve the same results, and you have to look at the impact, the cultural environment impact of doing it one way or another. Do people, when they get involved as listener members, have a way of being involved that is told, okay, these are the results will be managed, or and if they don't come out the way we want, then they will be, you know, shifted to achieve diversity as a social good. I am not putting a value judgment on that. I want people to understand that this is to be considered as a decision of bureaucratic impact, of cultural environment impact, and when a person then becomes involved, how do they become involved? Do they shift their concerns to the process itself, or do they allow a body, a bureaucratic body, to make this happen? This is a very deep issue on the left, and I think it needs to be assessed. People need to understand that there are valid ways of discussing this without accusing people of being anti-affirmative action or anti-democracy. We need to see it as what is the bureaucratic burden, what is the fiscal burden, and what is the cultural environment that is created, and we need to assess how that works through a civil and well-informed appreciation of each other's opinions, so that you can assess how this is affecting the foundation. So I please ask you to get involved. There are many people who would love more input in terms of the listeners need to become more acquainted with this so that they can offer their feedback. And the mediation hopefully will achieve something, but many people feel that this cannot be an accusatory process, that we have to assess on the merits of the cultural environment in the foundation and appreciate people's differences of opinion. So I offer that as a way of asking people to recognize that there are severe differences and we need to not accuse people and create an environment of civil discussion. Thank you for appreciating what you can on that. So, coming to our issue, childhood development and what this means to our lives, when you look at the need for a nonviolent world, the need for people to bring into being nonviolence, how does the individual play into this, and how is the individual psychology brought into being, and how does that create the society from the individual? And the formative years, the ecology of childhood development, is something that I think if we look at, we can learn what is happening on the individual level that then affects the society. As a way to just come into this in a nice musical manner, I would like to just bring in a bit of John Lennon on this, because he has addressed this in a very artistic fashion. John Lennon was, at 4 years old, he was separated from his family. His parents were divorced. He was given to an aunt to be raised, and he has really, in a lot of ways, created an artistic way of addressing this. Some of John's words that he wrote was that the worst pain is that of not being wanted. When I was a child, I experienced moments of not wanting to see the ugliness, not wanting to see not being wanted. This lack of love went into my eyes and into my mind. John Lennon, the song Mother.
Children, don't
to WBAI in New York. This is David O. I am with Pika Trinkle, my co-host for the day. Pika, how are you doing?
Doing fine, David.
Okay. Yeah, you're on, right? Okay. The this issue of primal needs and the primal environment. As a way of introduction, I had mentioned in the beginning, what can we learn from indigenous ways of bringing children into the world and what that means to the emotional health of the growing child. And as a moment of introduction here, I think the way in which some anthropologists have brought this out in terms of the in traditional societies, pre-industrial societies, the birth process took place in a quiet, natural setting. The outdoors was also, in some sense, another inside. Leaving the womb was not so traumatic because the natural environment was so conducive. In certain areas, it was very conducive. In other areas, not as much. But the social ecology within a natural environment was very conducive to nurturance. The experience of such a world is that the mother is always there. An infancy that begins like this flows gracefully into a lifelong sense of kinship with the natural world. So how in this society that we are in now, Pika, how do we sense the value of bringing children into the world, and how does that impact on our well-being, and what can we do to recreate, to emulate those natural birthrights that were taken for granted way back when?
Well, let me begin by just backing up a little bit to talk about why we might want to look at child rearing in an ecological perspective now more than ever. I think there are two basic reasons. The first is the environment. We have in our environment so much impact from the manufacture of drugs. Not only the manufacture of drugs, but the ingestion and elimination through urine of drugs through children and adults. Couple that with the impact of supplement manufacture on the environment, vaccine manufacture on the environment, pesticides, chemicals, food additives, colorings. You know, all of these things do not break down easily in the body. Neither do they break down once they are in the groundwater or in the soil. They impact our ecologies worldwide so that we see all kinds of malformations and sexual trait deviations among wildlife, even in the Antarctic. And these are known to be a direct result of xenoestrogens, which are chemicals that mimic estrogen in our bodies, in the bodies of all mammals. So that's the one perspective, the sort of wider world perspective. But then in terms of children's health, you know, we must also look at this internal ecology. And on a purely physiological level, when a child is born into our culture, the natural process of internal ecology, ecological development is hindered greatly. We have in our birth process in our culture, you know, any number of drug interventions, of surgical interventions, of narcotics, of epidurals, of drugs to the baby, of separating mother from baby, of all of these things. So let me just give a kind of a pretty picture of how it could be so that we can have a model to think from. As David was saying, within the womb, yes, all is perfect. It's perfect in there. It's a perfect environment. It's a perfect ecology for baby. And when a baby is born, this baby comes down through the birth canal completely, having been in a completely sterile, protected universe. And through the birth canal, what begins to happen is that the body begins to be populated with beneficial bacteria, beneficial flora, which then begin to formulate the baby's ability to adapt to the environment. When the baby is then put to the mother's breast, Generally, in a natural birth context, this is even before the umbilical cord is cut and the baby is laid upon the skin of the mother. Everyone focuses in on the baby now. The baby is put to the breast. And as that first milk, that colostrum, enters into the mucous membranes, there starts a process of population of flora through the milk that populates the entire gastrointestinal tract. This is the beginning of our immune system. And really, if you can just think about your own beginnings, many of us, I'm in my late 40s, I was lucky to be breastfed, but you know, many people have not been a result of a natural birth, have not been the result of a breastfeeding family. And so there is this somewhat of a lack there in their ability to have resilience in their health. So I think that when you're looking at the reasons, why would we want these most precious years to be protected? It has to do not only with our own personal health and development. You know, certainly we want our children to be healthy. We want our children to be strong. But if you're thinking along the lines of world health, this is of primary importance, and we have to re-educate people to how important it is.
So when we then look at the needs, the child's needs, not the institution's needs, but the child's needs at this critical moment in coming into the world, can we speak a little about this stage of what can be called evolved expectations? There's an author named Gene Liedloff, L-I-E-D-L-O-F-F, author of The Continuum Concept, and she concludes that the modern world's pathological suppression of our innate ecological connectedness begins from the moment of birth, and that separation of the infant from the mother violates the child's innate evolved expectations of the world, the expectations to be held, to be warm and secure close to the mother's body, and that this traumatic separation from the primary caregiver fails to establish in the infant's emotional life a sense of secure relatedness to the world. Can we speak a little bit about maybe your understanding, maybe some of your experiences with this, what would be called the in-arms stage of infant development?
Right. Well, here's where I think in the 50s we developed a culture of people who wanted things rather than relationships. When babies were born, they were immediately taken from the mother, given a bottle, wrapped in a blanket, and all their comfort came from things. I think if you extrapolate, you know, 30, 40 years later, you'll see why that primal need to relate and be close, you know, took the form of shopping. It's really unfortunate, but I think there is a connection there. The in-arms phase of a baby, those of you who may have had the experience of giving birth to a baby in a natural state or been present at a birth, when you see this baby come into the world, there's definitely a person right there, really, really beautiful, very aware. And if you really respond to this child at that moment, there is an interaction there. I mean, we're led to believe through books of various kinds that the baby can't see very well, the baby can't respond very well, but you will see this in a newborn, just this tremendous innate wisdom, almost as if, you know, the veil hasn't come down yet. They're just pure essence of being. And so here we have this person with exquisite sensitivity, exquisite newness to the world. This is where the messages for all sensation begin, right? So it is very important that the baby is touched, the baby is held, the baby is felt, it feels safe. If you think about that the skin and the nervous system are derived from the same embryonic cells, and your skin is filled with sensation, that this is something that you want in the beginning years to really show, yes, the world is a safe place. You know, we live in a culture that, and you see it in the supermarkets, you see it on the street, you know, people telling kids to be quiet, stop crying, stop complaining, da-da-da. With a baby, we push it all the way back to infancy, where we're told that if we pick up our baby when they're crying, that we're going to spoil them.
Yes, this is something I really want to emphasize, because the ideology around spoiling infants has really done a major disservice, to put it mildly, on child development, because young adults learn to manipulate, but babies communicate. They're not manipulating, they're communicating. And if you buy into this trap of you would be spoiling the baby by responding to their crying, that merely sets up this desperate, unfulfilled dependency and a desperation, and what can be called maternal deprivation. It's an emotional deprivation that carries into adult behavior, where there's adult regression to infantile behavior in the hopes of being treated at last as the infant that is still within, you know, and this starving for experience, desperate efforts to win approval and recognition. And I think this is key to personality development, and how that personality development affects the social environment in which we live, and how important. Can you describe your experience with this physiological entrainment that the child demands and needs from the mother, that if the child does not, certainly the first 9 months and probably even to the first 2 years, if the child does not experience that physiological entrainment with the mother's breathing, the mother's heart, that there's this loss of integrity to the biophysiology?
Right. Well, you know, I think the need is so great, and to be held and touched as a human being. And I think, you know, I just wanted to say, because I am a mother. I'm a mother of three. I had three boys within, you know, under 5 years. And so I know that there are times and you can't pick up your baby. You know, you have other things that are taking priority. It's almost a triage situation, you mm-hmm. know. And so it's important to keep in mind also that when we're talking about a natural context, it is not a natural context for a mother to be alone with children, taking care of the children in isolation.
Right.
It's not a natural context to live outside of a group in this way where we do, where, you know, there's a man and a woman, or a woman and a woman with children, or man and a man with children, right, in this separate unit. So the in-arms phase is really about the community welcoming the baby being loved and being cared for. I mean, there are several cultures around the world that never allow the baby to touch the ground for the first 6 months, because symbolically the baby is not really fully incorporated, not fully in the body yet.
Yes.
And so must be held and protected. And if you think about brain development, a human mother cannot give birth to a baby that has complete brain development. The head would be too big for the anatomy. So really, it's important to think about babies from the age of birth till 6 months, almost more as marsupials, where they must be carried. No other mammal in the world is so incompetent at birth. No other mammal can't either swim or walk or get around in some way. A human baby has a window of time during which it could crawl up to the mother's breast. But after that, the physical ability is slow to develop. And really, only a very precocious baby is going to be crawling around 6 months, you
yes.
know.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about it this way, it's a logical, you know, if you were left on your own with no one's advice, and you had this baby, right, who cried and was calling for you, you'd pick up the baby. I think that most people's instincts are at that place. Mm-hmm. But it's an enculturated idea that we shouldn't do this too much, because if we do it too much, God forbid we should show our children we love them too much. We should hold them too much. A need denied is a need deferred.
Yes.
We only have to look now at what happens in teenage years, where there's another big thrust of growth, the enormous drug use, the enormous need for stimulation, the enormous confusion as to identity, right? That these things, you know, if we could look at our culture and say we have a culture that sustains a healthy population of children, then I would buy all the arguments in favor of the way we've been doing things.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't. You know, we really do not. Even the most privileged families, and I include myself in that group, who have had the ability and the wherewithal to be able to care for our kids the way we want to, even then, the culture has impacted the family life.
Even more so in upper income families, this is even more of a problem, I feel, because there's the financial support for more materiality that intervenes between the child and the parent, and this cuts across all economic strata and all peoples now, because we've all been westernized and industrialized, and what I feel is so important too is you mentioned a story when we were speaking earlier about how one of your children was lacking in, there was a moment of a malady or illness, and it wasn't until you yourself calmed down and transmitted that bioenergetic mm-hmm. feeling to the child that the child actually then recovered well-being. Can you quickly
right.
describe
yeah,
that?
Yeah, that's a great story. It taught me really a lot. My second son, when he was 4 months old, I had taken a part-time job, and I was out of the house a little more than I had been, and he got a fever and a respiratory illness at that time, and I came home and I was in a total panic, because at 4 months it's young to have a fever and a respiratory infection, and I just didn't know where to start. I was nervous. He was breathing very quickly. I was looking up in all my books about how fast is too fast to breathe, and he was very, very fast. And I was just getting myself worked up into this total panic until I realized, you know, here I was carrying this poor baby around with me, myself in a total panic, and he was regulating to my energy.
Mm.
So when I realized how upset I was, I took the time to calm myself down and really did some breathing and got centered and reassured myself that this wasn't a life-threatening situation, and just looked at him. And within 5 minutes, I would say, the respiratory rate came down. I mean, I've had so many experiences like this where the mother, as the matrix, really does hold the energy for the family. And certainly that's another place where our culture impacts the autonomy of families. But it taught me a lot about how babies really do regulate to the adults or even the other children in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And that in terms of little babies sleeping, I mean, this is why, you know, worldwide, babies never, ever slept on their own. You don't see in even 100 years ago in Western culture, you didn't see people put a baby in a crib down the hall in another room of the house. You needed your baby close by to make sure that everything was okay, but also so that the baby could regulate to the respiration and the heart rate of the parents. And now, you know, if you look in the stores, you'll find actually little devices that you can put in the crib that play the sounds of the heartbeat. Right? Because it's supposed to be extremely calming and soothing to the baby.
No, that's an artificial compensation that is not, I don't believe, is going to do what really is the birthright mm-hmm. of the child. And before we leave this topic, this does affect the way people utilize tools for caring for their children. And rather than believe that there's a convenience in strollers and carriages and things. The indigenous method was a sling that kept the baby very close to the body very naturally. And you can simply maybe just give us a little information on how people can utilize this very simple method of carrying the baby close to the body that is physically not difficult if you have the right kind of sling. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, let me put it a little broader, mm-hmm. which is, you know, people, I taught childbirth classes for over 10 years, and parents would always ask me, you know, what do I need? What do I need to get for the baby? And I said, really, you don't need much of anything. You know, you need some diapers, and you need some clothing, and you need a couple of blankets, and you need food for yourself. But other than that, there's no contraptions you actually need at first. And as far as strollers and these carriers and things like this, it's a lot of stuff that really we've bought into this idea that we need. I never really used a stroller because for a couple of reasons. One, I lived in a very small house. Two, I had a very small car, so I couldn't actually deal with equipment and children, you know, so I chose to carry them. And carrying is much easier with a sling or some kind of a backpack or some kind of a side pack or some way that you would not have to use the strength of your arms all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to, you know, go up to people in the supermarket who are actually carrying their babies and say, how wonderful that you're carrying your baby.
Yeah.
It's not a common thing. It's yeah. really not. If you look around, most people are putting their babies into something else. And I think it's just something to examine. Certainly, I understand practical issues. You're shopping or you're going to the park. You have equipment. You have to carry other things. But as a general rule, as much as possible, I think human contact is very important for healthy development.
Yes. It's also called baby wearing. If you look at the cultural the resources that we have, many of the traditional cultures, it was called wearing the baby, mm-hmm. and it's a very wonderful way for the child to you never experience this thought, well, am I spoiling the child? It's just a natural coexistence that provides that true foundational security that brings children.
And I think too that just as a parent, when you can really acknowledge the needs of your child as an infant and as a toddler, where it's hard work as mm-hmm. a parent, it gives you the tools later on to deal with adolescence and issues of teenage.
Right.
If you understand their needs and the level at which they call on you, you'll see that pattern repeating again at certain ages. At age 9 is significant, at age 12, and various other times. You'll see those same issues coming up in slightly different
yes,
contexts. But
yes.
you understand the nature of that child, and you're able to meet their needs in a more comprehensive way.
Okay, you're listening to WBAI in New York. We will take a quick moment of listening to John Lennon for a few seconds as we reappraise the situation and bring you some more Ecologic, Our Common Fate. Thank you for listening.
People say we got it made. Don't they know we're so afraid? Isolation. Alone, everybody got to have a home. Isolation, just a boy and a little girl trying to change the whole wide world. Just a little town, everybody trying to pull us down.
You are listening to EcoLogic. We are with Pika Trinkle, a natural health educator, homeopath, naturopath, and we are speaking about the ecology of childhood development. Pika, let's speak a little bit about this ecological model of the immune system. There's an author, Daniel Mowry. He wrote The Next Generation Herbal Medicine, and he feels that the phrase the immune system is really oversimplified shorthand for a whole host of individual actions emanating from all the body's functional systems that we have. When we say the immune system, we really are glossing over so much that's really happening. Can you speak a bit about this ecological model?
Yeah, first, though, I'm not a naturopath.
Okay, sorry. You're a natural. You're on a natural path.
Yeah, I'm on a natural path.
Okay.
All right, so the immune system, yes, the immune system is the whole body, but I would say it's important to look at the definition of the word immune and reexamine what we're calling this function in the body. Immune means not affected or responsive, and exempt, right? So immunity is the quality or condition of being immune. I think that we need to think of our immunity more as adaptability. There is a quote that I dug up out of a 1928 pharmacotherapeutics book, and it goes, "Life is a continuous adjustment of internal relations to external relations. Living beings maintain a moving equilibrium in harmony with their changing environment by automatically affecting internal changes to counterbalance external ones. The ability to affect such counterbalancing adjustments promptly and adequately constitutes health." So this ability to make these, you know, continual adjustments. If you think of the immune system as an interaction with the external environment, we're on a better footing. And also to think of it as a self-organizing energy of the vital force. Mm. It's the way that the body takes care of itself. And also to remember that really all healing is self-healing. So that you're really looking to be in a harmonious relationship with your environment, whatever that may be. You know, and so it's important to look at the flora and bacteria within the body as a terrain which is fostered by proper living and nutrition. Kids today are not fed proper foods. I know I keep sounding more like an old fuddy-duddy with this sort of, they must have proper foods. But but the wholesome foods, the whole foods, the pure foods, pureness is really wholeness and completeness. You know, and our kids today are really eating a lot of refined stuff with a lot of chemicals in it.
Right. So the chemicals then become with and as food that the body says, well, if this is food, but it's actually, you know, not really, it's the word xenobiotic, not natural to the biosystem, and that what does that do to the vital force needing to constantly be on guard and never having the release of just not having to be always in a defensive mode.
Right. There is a state of hyper alert when everything that comes into the mouth has something that is non-food attached to it.
Right.
And so the lymphatic system is always busy trying to clear that away. And if everything that we eat has a chemical in it that is a non-food item that the body has to clear as a poison, then at a certain point, I think the immune system decides that must be safe. It's coming in every day as food. I mean, how many years is it going to be on hyper alert? And so we have then a condition wherein the body can't distinguish self or good, safe, from something that doesn't belong there.
Right.
And that is the terrain that promotes cancer. That is where the body cannot distinguish between self and other very well anymore.
Wow.
And doesn't do its own self-regulating as well. And we have really an enormous increase of cancer as the years go by. So this idea of whole foods, it is something that is, it's not just sort of It's not as simple as just, well, I'm going to be a vegetarian, or I'm going to, you know, take care of my family in this way. It is a global issue. This issue of food and water now is so huge. And the more that we can actually take back control of our food sheds, our ways of agriculture, you know, teach our children where food comes from, all of it, you know, it's part of a whole. See, our kids are growing up in a way where they have no idea what is actually going on, you know, and their intelligence is being compromised by the poor foods, the multitudes of drugs and vaccinations and whatnot that are getting put into their bloodstreams. They're becoming hypersensitive or having pathological reactions to things that should not be harmful.
Right.
Pollens and dog dander and these things that, you know, we should be resilient to these things, but
right.
Our kids are developing more chronic illness, very preoccupied with recurrent ear infections, tonsillitis, you know, allergies, all of these things which are a result of being off track in proper development.
Now, on that issue, the inflammatory response and the difference between a short-term beneficial inflammation and fever that creates health, or the low-grade chronic inflammation or fever that climbs too high and becomes possibly life-threatening. How do parents distinguish between these sorts of inflammation and the, what is the need to not suppress the inflammatory response? Because that's another issue of how is the organism communicating with the environment.
Well, all children get inflammation, and I should say right off the top that being healthy doesn't mean never being sick.
Right, exactly.
I think that's real important for parents to understand. And from birth to age 6 is where the immune system is in its process of developing. This means that when a young child, say a toddler who's getting more molars and teeth coming in, will develop a fever, have inflammation in the upper respiratory tract, this is a very, very common thing. And it's not something that you don't want to treat, but it's something that you want to be careful how you treat. So there are many, many simple, natural, palliative measures to take to make the child more comfortable, to keep the child from getting more, you know, sicker, without going to your Tylenols and other suppressive medications. And in this way, you foster a proper development over time. Certainly, if a child is in a situation where they're having repeated infections and the parents decide they no longer want to go the medical route, you simply can't just do that. You have to have somebody there to guide you through. I mean, there's certainly infections and inflammations which are dangerous. But for young children, I mean, I spend a lot of my teaching time teaching families how to take care of their children in natural, non-suppressive, palliative ways that support natural health in the child and allow the family to move forward drug-free. I take seriously just say no to drugs. I mean, this is something that I find really frightening, how many, many drugs, over-the-counter drugs, prescription drugs, and all of the drugs for behavior control that kids are being given. And in any way, if there is any way that I can be a small voice to help to stem that tide, I will do this because I feel that it is the birthright of our children to live drug-free and to be able to know. See, part of what happens as a child grows in a natural setting with, you know, good food and love and everything, they get a sense of what actually is good for them and what is not good for them. And they are then able to take care of themselves.
Yes, the phrase conferring more responsibility actually brings about more freedom. The link between responsibility and freedom. Maybe you can speak a little bit about that, and that might lead into empowerment issues.
Okay, so you know, you can never have true freedom without taking responsibility. And this is something that we say, oh, we want to be free, we're a free country. Well, we're a country that doesn't really take much responsibility for anything. The individuals that I, you know, come across don't really have a full understanding of what being responsible means. The more responsibility you can take for your own well-being, the greater freedom you will have to be able to utilize any aspect of the culture. So in other words, if you're a parent who is willing to really sit with every decision and be the one where, you know, these decisions are made, rather than giving this decision-making privilege to a doctor or a teacher or an authority of some sort. Even if you need the help of a professional, if you take full responsibility for every decision, you will have more freedom as a parent over time. I mean, this is a huge issue because authority is undermined at every level for parents.
Hmm.
And I would just say I guess we just have a few minutes left. I think it's very important to have compassion for ourselves as parents and to understand that, you know, we have no idea why John Lennon's mother left him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? Life happens and
yes.
Sad things happen to people and tough things happen to people, and life doesn't always unfold in this perfect way
exactly. We
think it should or wish it would. So, in other words, if things are not perfect in your family, it doesn't mean you throw everything out.
Right.
You just take where you can and you make it better.
Yes, that where you can allow that natural love to manifest in surveying what options are available.
Yes.
In other words, if you are in a situation where the vaccination, you couldn't fight it off and the child did get vaccinated against your wishes, to not keep modeling anxiety and panic, but to say, well, what can I do to give that child the strength despite that violation?
Things like taking your children to the beach, going to a botanical garden.
Yes.
You know, doing simple things that don't cost anything, that put the child into a natural area.
Yes.
Every human being has an innate need for these, an innate understanding of the natural world. And you never see people going to parking lots to do deep relaxation. You know what I mean? You know?
Yes.
You see them going to the park, sitting under trees, sitting in a garden, sitting by a river. It doesn't really matter where it is, but to just expose the child to that natural wonder
right.
that is really there always.
And in New York City, we really have easy access to many wonderful refuges between the coastal areas and the parks, but also quickly, can we talk about reading the sky? It's a very costless way to bring your child in relation to the earth, just to encourage your child to look towards the sky and to learn about the sky through their relationship with the sky.
For many years we homeschooled, and no longer, but we did. And one year we took on study of weather. And we got all the books out of the library, studied the clouds, studied how to read what was coming, and we would predict the weather. And then we would always check on the news or the Weather Channel or the paper, you know, what were they predicting. And we were almost always right. And I can't say that the Weather Channel was always right. We know this, don't we? And so it is something that you can just look up, just have a child have some opportunity not to have every moment scheduled.
Right,
you know,
right.
Have some freedom.
Free time versus managed time. Okay, so quick, can you give your phone number, Pika, for people who can
if
get in?
If people would like to contact me, they can call my office in New Jersey at 973-257-1046.
Okay, and you can contact me, David O, at davido@wbai.org, davido@wbai.org. The Continuum Concept by Jean Liedloff, and The Irreducible Needs of Children by T. Brazelton. If you want to contact me about these educational resources for the ecology of childhood development, please do. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned to WBAI in New York. The Community Bulletin Board is up, right, Natalie? And Gary Null is next. Thank you for listening.